This is Conspiranormal.
All right, guys, welcome back to Conspiranormal. It's good to be back. I had Walter Bosley on last week, and this week we've got two for one. We have the hosts of the great podcast Great Lakes Lore, one of which is Aaron Gullius, who you guys have heard many, many times on this show. This is probably like, you know,
maybe
episode
once or twice.
37 with Aaron Gullius.
42.
Maybe Soraya has had you on more than I have, but I think that's possible.
I think that's probably the only one that's likely, yeah.
But we have also first-time guest, co-host of Great Lakes Lore, Samantha Engel. Welcome to Conspiranormal for your first time.
Thank you. Thanks.
Great to have you guys. I was listening to you guys' show in preparation for this. It's always great when I can like listen to a podcast, because my job primarily requires me to be in the car. I could just sit there and just listen to podcasts, just let it go, and instead of like reading a book or something like that. So thoroughly have enjoyed it. Like I told you guys before, I'm like halfway through all the topics, but we'll start with you, Samantha, since Aaron's been on a lot. We could talk a little bit about like kind of your vision for the show and what made you want to do a podcast about weird happenings and interesting things in the Great Lakes region.
Yeah, sure. So I am a historian. I work in public history, so museum work primarily. But I have always been very interested in weird, creepy, spooky stuff. even as a kid, that was totally my jam. I was like, please, no Little House on the Prairie. I need all of the goosebumps. So
there was a ghost episode of Little House on the Prairie.
There probably was.
And it was really freaky. I'm not going to lie.
I remember that one. Yeah.
Yes. Oh. Yes.
Maybe I'll have to.
It had like a moving doll and everything too. It was it scared the hell out of me. I was like,
well, dolls are always creepy. So, yeah. But yeah, no. And so I've always like carried that interest throughout everything, kind of in the background. And, I, you know, several years ago began really diving into podcasts and had met Aaron through my previous museum job. And, you know, knew he had the podcast. And so as we spoke more and talked more and whatever, and realized we really enjoyed talking about these weird topics, and really had, you know, our own unique approach as historians. So, you know, what is the myth? What is the legend? Now let's go dive into genealogy records or old newspapers and things like that, and sort of apply our historical research background and historical knowledge to these types of stories to try and get to the heart of them if possible, or just have some fun exploring them and chatting about them. And so slowly I kind of pitched the idea to Aaron, and he seemed to think he could do two podcasts, which I think is impressive. So yeah, that's kind of, I think, largely how it came about, and how like I sort of conceived of it and how we thought about it as we were putting things together. And we liked sort of the regionality of it too, because I'm interested in sort of ideas of place and things like that. And so I'm a Michigan born, raised Michigan girl. And there's just, having also lived outside of the Great Lakes region for a little bit, there's a unique thing that goes on here. And so exploring some of those topics, maybe within that, with that lens of, you know, what is sort of regional identity, or how do folks approach things in this part of the country or world?
Absolutely. I think all, just like politics, you know, all paranormal is local.
Yeah.
And what are some like unique historical circumstances that lend to the character of the legends and different phenomena in this area?
Yeah. So, well, we recently did an episode on the Lake Ontario Triangle. And so I've always enjoyed Great Lakes maritime history. And although this is a bit further away than, you know, the Great Lakes that are touching Michigan, it was really fun to look into that. And we have a few other topics in mind for future episodes that really sort of, you know, I think put into perspective, especially for people maybe not from the region, how large the lakes are and how they have their own mythos around them and their own culture around them, and really how folks from this region really, I think, cling to these ideas as part of, you know, a maritime history, which perhaps, you know, someone in, I don't know, Oklahoma wouldn't think Michigan has a maritime history or something like that. So I think that's a good example of that. But just, I mean, the various industries that have come through the region, Native American and indigenous legends that impact things, how the region was settled. It's all a very kind of unique story.
I think one of the things about this region, apart from the maritime stuff, and one of the things Sam said on one of our episodes is we have to remember that the Great Lakes are, they're lakes, but they're almost inland freshwater seas. Like as far as the currents and the weather, it's not like, you know, the lake you go, you know, with your cabin on it necessarily. Right. But one of the things for me is, I mean, I'm from Indiana, which is, I mean, literally, it's a liminal state. It's the most liminal state. There is no such thing as Indiana. There are a bunch of different distinct regions that coalesce into Indiana because we had to draw the lines somewhere. And so the entire Great Lakes region is a place that people pass through and some of them stay, which means there is a huge variety of different cultures, different waves of immigration overlapping with each other, with their own, you know, cultures and legends and lore that they bring with them. And I think that's another aspect of it is that the population is, you know, very diverse over time, depending on when and where you look, from the indigenous people to, you know, like I said, the different sort of phases of immigration that that come through. It's a more diverse area than people give it credit for. It sort of gets lumped into, oh, you have a bunch of German people in the Midwest. No, it's much more strange than that sometimes.
And I guess you define the Great Lakes, Great Lakes area as like what, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin.
Minnesota.
Right? Minnesota.
And then we threw in Pennsylvania and New York because they touch Great Lakes too.
it's weird because, yeah, I mean, New York touches two Great Lakes, right? Mm-hmm. Erie and Ontario and Pennsylvania, Lake Erie. But, you know, they don't feel like Great Lakes states. No offense to them, but they don't have that feel because they're also coastal. You know, so it's like their maritime history is sort of eastern seaboard maritime history. Philadelphia is a port city.
There's also, I think, a lot of connections between those states and those regions. You know, there's a lot of immigration that happens from, or migration that happens from northern New York and into Pennsylvania, into Michigan, just because of, you know, kind of following Erie Canal and the Great Lakes and similar landscapes. I have a lot of ancestors that took that route here in the mid 1800s. And so I think you do find some of those overlaps in those parts of the states, but they're more, well known, I guess, for other areas.
I guess anything that's covered by the Northwest Ordinance.
Thank you. One of our, when we were trying to think of titles for the show, Sam, was the one I came up with, was it like Legends of the Old Northwest?
You and I both like pitched a couple of things that had Old Northwest in them, and we're like, but people are going to think we're talking about the Pacific Northwest, so we ditched it.
I just don't know too many podcasts that deal with, like, you know, ghosts and cryptids and strange occurrences that mention the Northwest Ordinance and the Jay Treaty of 1795.
Which I think is a huge oversight, but it does sort of set us apart. You know, we haven't talked. Sam, have we done an entire episode of the Land Ordinance of 1785?
I don't think that's gonna fly past the vetting process.
You know, it was written by Thomas Jefferson.
Well, I do.
Okay, you're as a Thomas Jefferson fan.
I'm a big Thomas Jefferson fan. I wrote my master's thesis on Jefferson, so Jefferson is my jam. But
you'd have to get the Articles of Confederation and set all that up.
Right.
Anyway,
watch the numbers drop.
I was listening to a couple of days ago, and I was like, yeah, like they really just mentioned the Jay Treaty. Like, no one ever has. I don't usually hear that on other shows, but
well, that land ordinance is where the you know, the secret Masonic surveyors went out and put everything into a grid. So
yeah,
so there's probably something to it.
Because aren't there a lot of counties in Michigan and Ohio that are like almost perfect squares? Isn't that like a thing? Yeah.
Yep. Anything in the Northwest Territory is pretty rectilinear.
Not necessarily square, but yeah, at least rectangular.
Yeah.
And then divided up into its townships and
which are generally square.
Yes, those are. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all a vast Masonic conspiracy.
So you would cover those states, but you wouldn't cover maybe like Kentucky or, in the case, I think the closest that you got was when you talked about the witch's castle,
which I think is right across from Louisville.
Yep.
But in Indiana. So
that's the thing. Like Illinois, Ohio, Indiana are Great Lakes states, but they're also Ohio Valley states. Mm-hmm. So that gives us a little sort of cheat code to talk about Ohio Valley stuff sparingly, you know, because it's not really our remit to do that. But
well, we also want to, you know, appeal to a broader audience too. Right. So it helps us bring in some extra topics.
But if you ever feel compelled to do an entire episode on the Jay Treaty, just let me know. Maybe we can.
I've tried. Didn't fly.
Let's get into some of these cases that you guys talk about. And this was one that, of course, like I had never heard of. Not, and I think not being from that area, I would have heard of it. And that's the Dudgeon Swamp Mystery. And this is more, I guess, kind of a true crime, because it's based in an actual murder case from, I think, the 1920s, something like that. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Sam, it's your hometown. So
it is my hometown. And it is a story that I had grown up hearing about. My parents definitely fed my spooky obsessions and, you know, told me all the good ghost stories and things. And we actually grew up, well, my parents still live there, kind of down the road and across the street from where this swamp area is. And so, you know, heard the story many times. Of course, I didn't learn about the incest babies until I was of an appropriate age to learn about incest baby ghosts. But, you know, it was something I'd always wondered about, like, well, what is the real story to this? Because just hearing it from people in town or my parents telling the story, it's very much just sort of this oral tradition, you know, something that's just passed down to everybody. And so we decided to start digging into it and found a lot of newspaper coverage throughout the whole state on the trial and what was going on. And, you know, the things that we found definitely countered sort of what the prevailing narrative is. And, you know, if you go on YouTube or whatever and search the swamp, you'll find like all of these sort of especially a lot of young kid, like ghost hunters who are like, we're going to go out in the swamp in the middle of the night and find the ghost. And I'm like, you're probably just going to, you know, be attacked by a bear, honestly, because they're there. But, you know, none of them are actually trying to figure out what the story is. They're just trying to find, you know, the ghost or just something
legend
like
tripping.
That.
Yeah,
exactly. Yep. And getting lots of details very wrong. We recently just were Googling around and found this terrible article somebody wrote or blog post that, I mean, even the names of the people and who was involved was all messed up and backwards. And, you know, I think it was worthwhile trying to dig to what, you know, as much of the fact, because you can never know the true fact necessarily of what the case was. So.
Well, that might be okay around like a campfire. It's not really, you know, you don't want to write it down or talk about it on a recording if it's, you know.
Right. And it's, I don't want to say it's a straightforward murder case, but it's, you know, a woman kills her husband and then they go back and suspect that the elderly father-in-law who died 6 months before might have been murdered too. And then there's a sensational, well-covered murder trial, and there's, you know, convictions, and there's all this like ghost stories that pop up, and stories about babies born, mm-hmm. but, you know, brother and sister mm-hmm. having babies, and then ghosts show up, and it's you just hear these little when we started looking at it. I mean, I was unfamiliar with it completely. We start looking at accounts, and it's like it's just weird stuff. And you look at the newspapers, and it just doesn't match up. So it was a good first episode to sort of set out our stall of what we are doing mm-hmm. and with the mm-hmm. show, and sort of this intersection of weird history and trying to find some semblance of fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were some of the things that you found out? What were some of the specifics of the case? And there was also a very interesting way that they tried to get these people to confess.
Yes.
Yes. So, and this was something that, you know, I had always heard growing up too, is that the townspeople who were very unfriendly towards the Dudgeon family sort of put together this lynching mob, and they ran down the two brothers and strung them up and, you know, forced a confession out of them, which later, of course, they recanted and said, well, no, you were hanging me. Of course, I'm going to, agree to whatever you're saying. And it's really interesting because for the episode, we had access to like some of the bigger national or not national, the larger state newspapers, the Detroit Free Press, Grand Rapids, things like that. But recently we took a trip back to White Cloud and went to the local library and looked at the actual White Cloud newspaper, and the difference in the perspectives between the two, especially on the lynch mob, was very interesting. So whereas like the Detroit Free Press, you know, these, uncouth people of White Cloud, terrible people doing terrible things, whatever. In the White Cloud newspaper, they referred to it as a lynching bee, which I feel sounds very arts and craftsy.
Yeah, right.
And yes. And, you know, they like interviewed some of the members of the lynching bee, and, you know, they deserved to find out the truth, and the police weren't doing enough, and they wanted to find out what was going on. So the perspective differences were stark.
And in the major state newspapers, sort of the ghosty thing that was, it just sort of came across as the state detectives who came in were accused of, you know, faking ghost stories to scare people into confessions. But in the local papers, it was much more clear that there were claimed to be, it was more elaborate than that. Mm-hmm. It was more involved than that. It was more something that would be mistaken for or interpreted as an actual haunting.
Yeah. So you can see how that traveled down. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Travels. Yeah.
Even like while it was taking place, pretty much. Yeah. It's already playing the telephone game.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And you've got the big city papers sort of dismissing it, and these rubes, you know, sort of out in the woods, the swamp Sally's out in the woods, you know, causing trouble. And, you know, but the local papers, so-and-so said that, you know, she saw the ghost of such and such, you know, roaming in the night or something like that. It's taken a little bit more seriously, not mm-hmm. completely seriously, mm-hmm. but not dismissed as, you know, these crackers out in the woods are, you know, crazy or something like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But didn't they try to like dress as ghosts or something? Wasn't there something like that?
Yeah. And this, I never heard this before. So when we first came across that in the larger newspapers, it was nutso. But yeah, basically these three, they painted them as like these three rogue state troopers rolled into town, and they were there to like figure out what exactly was going on. And yeah, they like took the brothers, each of the brothers, I think the mother and the daughter, all to this barn, the barn where the man was found hanged, and dressed up as ghosts to try to scare them into confessing.
All right.
Like, were they literally like wearing sheets? Like, was it?
So.
Yeah. Yeah. I think
eyes.
Yes. You know? Right. The one maybe cut too many holes like Charlie Brown.
Charlie Brown. Yeah. Yeah. It's very strange. You this is definitely a pre-Miranda rights sort of sort right. of you know, legal system, but it's amazing what it's just, there's in some of the local papers, what we found was the attitude of the local people in the town who were in the, what do you call it, the audience or the,
I know.
The spectators,
yeah. The mob,
the yeah. mob in the courtroom, their animosity toward the defendants was so great that their attorney truly believed that it influenced the jury, but the jury was made up of the same people as everybody else. And this family had supposedly a reputation as troublemakers. And so when they're accused of murder, nobody really bats an eye.
Well, and they were really upset with them. Like, they had moved to town and apparently bought this huge swath of land that a lot of folks used to like graze their cows on and do all these other things with. And so it's hard to know if like the animosity was just like because of this, like a sort of land rights argument, or if really, and that's sort of the next question Aaron and I want to figure out, is look at papers like pre-murder and see if these dungeons were truly like rabble rousers, always making trouble, getting in fights.
Because there's one story that like, didn't the mom like knife a teacher?
Yeah, something. I don't remember.
You see, like, it's like she once roughed up a teacher or something like that. And it's like, there's got to be some paperwork on that.
Yeah.
You know, even in West Michigan in you know, the early 20th century, there's got to be something. So when we went out there last time, it was a Saturday because jobs, and the library was open. We were able to get 3 hours in, and a good 20 minutes of that was figuring out the microfilm machine. So, I touched it. It fell apart. I was not allowed to touch it again. rough scene, man. So we're hoping to go out there again on hopefully a weekday when
eventually
somebody can, you know, give us enough time to look through stuff.
So you guys are going to continue to look into this, and there's probably going to be a part two at some point.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if I can mention this, Sam. This is what we're thinking about for our presentation for the conference in October.
Okay,
is sort of this ongoing investigation, including trying to get some histories and commentary from people who grew up there, what they have heard over the years, comparing that to what Sam heard growing up, and so sort of the community tradition of this, bring in some family memories from one of the family of the victim. One of them wrote a memoir of what she learned growing up and heard about it growing up. So sort of this like the how the ghosty stuff fits in, and how the history fits in, and how this concept of misremembering sort of works.
Was there some animosity to the fact that maybe that you had, that they were kind of out in the country a little bit and you had the townspeople? Was there a little bit of class struggle going on there, that these people were poorer? And
I think a lot of White Cloud at that time was backwoodsy. I don't think that from nothing that I've read or the bit of that older White Cloud history that I know, I don't really get that sense necessarily, but it's definitely something to remember, or, you know, to keep in mind as we're looking. But, you know, a lot of the folks there were, you know, they were working as stumpers or, you know, trying to eke out a living off the land. And White Cloud is still super tiny, not big. So
yeah, I was checking to see where it was.
Yeah.
I think most of the classism and the snobbery comes from reporters from outside the area who are doing the reporting. And it's like, you know, these backwards people, you know, don't even know it's wrong to kill people because they've never read the Bible.
What year was this? This was 1920.
22.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're kind of in the same, you're really in the same era that, I mean, lynchings are going on all over the place.
So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And these aren't, there's not the racial connotations to this lynching,
but
the notion of people, you know, just here's a mob to take the law into their own hands. It's not unheard of. It, just the way the papers reported it, it was not presented as something like, we cannot believe anything like this could happen in our town. It was just like,
yeah, not at all.
A group of solid citizens got together to take the law, you know, to the next level, something mm-hmm. like that.
So moving on, you also did a little bit of something about the Mad Gasser, and this is Mattoon, Illinois. So I guess it fits in with the Great Lakes region or the theme. Was there anything that you guys found out about this case that interested you?
No.
Yeah.
I think this one was one of mine that I mm-hmm. sort of pitched, right? Mm-hmm. You can tell you can if you go down the list, you can tell the Sam episodes and the Aaron episodes as far as who pitched them. But I think I knew about it, but I didn't know a lot about it. And one of the things that really surprised me was just the extensive newspaper coverage and sort of the way there was just this alarm, this almost mm-hmm. panicky note mm-hmm. in the newspapers that stops almost dead in its tracks once you get to a certain point. It's like, oh, there's no more Mad Gasser. We're not worried about this anymore. It's almost like somebody flips a switch and, you know, the attacks drop off and there's, you know, suspicion that, you know, oh, well, they've, you know, caught whoever it is or suspect whoever it is. And then this science teacher a few years ago wrote a book saying it was a local Farley, right? His name is Farley. Mm-hmm. He's a local chemist or chemistry student or person who knew a lot about chemistry. And his family had issues with other people in the town and sort of traces it to that and says that, you know, the cases where the Mad Gasser left like women's shoe prints, that was his sisters who sort of mm-hmm. like jumped in to, I don't know, sub for him when he couldn't do it. I don't know. It's not a well-written book, but
sis, I can't go around gassing people tonight. Can you take over for me?
It's like, oh, sis, come on, man. I'm tired. I gassed people all night last night. But yeah, the Mad Gasser thing is interesting because, you know, it's such a compact little episode in one town's history, but there are like action figures that were produced and somebody did a graphic novel that is like about the Mad Gasser, but the plot is nothing. It's like a modern day guy who dresses up like the old Mad Gasser and like murders people.
Yeah.
And it's without gas. But he gasses them, then cuts them up. Right. So it's just one of these things where the legend of it has completely outstripped how interesting the original story actually was.
And the thing I thought was interesting was, like, I think because we looked up like the Mattoon Historical Society's website and all that. And since I work in public history and I'm interested in public memory and how, you know, areas commemorate things, and they had like nothing on it. So it's clearly something that the town itself doesn't really want to remember, share, put out there like, hey, come check out our exhibit on the Mad Gasser or anything like that. And part of it could be that, well, I mean, there's not really artifacts, right? Right. So I don't know what an exhibit would look like, but for it to be something that has spawned such outside like myth and creation of pop culture-y type things mm-hmm. in the town, it's not something that they appeared to be interested in, I think. Wasn't that, Aaron, I think, yeah, I'm right in remembering that.
Yeah. I can't remember if we talked about it on the show, but I was expecting there to be like Mad Gasser days. You know, it's like, this is the sort of thing you build a festival around.
Right.
You bring in people in, you have a Mad Gasser costume contest. You do stuff like that, but nothing.
Nope.
I was going to say it lends itself to being more paranormal, not someone who is going, you know, you got all the trappings of a paranormal thing. You got the odors going on, which Joshua Cutchin talks about, of course, and then
Cutch would go off on those
things. Paralysis and all that, from what I'm looking at, also known as the anesthetic prowler.
I really think they should have kept that name. The anesthetic prowler sounds much more menacing than the Mad Gasser.
You guys in the show compare it to Spring Hill Jack, which is another one of these weird characters, and there's a little bit of Men in Black mythos in this stuff too.
Yeah. Spring Hill Jack does. I mean, there was like one article back in the 70s that sort of made that connection between the Mad Gasser and Spring Hill Jack. And I think, was it Jerome Clark or Lauren Coleman? Lauren, I know you're listening to this because you track every mention of your name everywhere, but if I'm wrong, don't yell at me. Yeah, somebody made that Spring Hill Jack Mad Gasser connection, and then there are the Men in Black Spring Hill Jack connections. So the transitive property I remember from math classes, Mad Gasser is connected to the Men in Black, and all these sort of dark clad figures who are mm-hmm. menacing and frightening sort of get sort of put into one silo. You can't see me, but I'm talking with my hands a lot, listeners. But they get put into one sort of box in a lot of ways.
Samantha, any thoughts on the Mad Gasser?
No, not anything else. Aaron pretty much covered, what we found, and yeah, I was fascinated by the public memory stuff. So,
well, we'll have to be sensationalistic here and talk about Dogman, because that's all the rage. So much so that actually in August, there's actually a Dogman conference going to be here in Tennessee.
In Paris, Tennessee.
Now, I'm not sure that Dogman has ever been cited in Tennessee, but it's happening here anyway. And I'm really thinking about going, seriously.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'd love to hear about it.
But, this is the big, the Beast of Bray Road, the Linda Godfrey material. This is Wisconsin, so this is a, I guess that this is something that really kind of starts in the Great Lakes region.
Yeah, and so this was a me topic, because again, it was something I had heard about. I think I was in college probably when I first heard about Dogman, and there were many different directions that we could have taken with the episode, and obviously there are big, Linda Godfrey has big ideas about, these dog creatures cited all over the place. But we decided to keep it specifically to Michigan, to make it digestible, at least for this episode. And really looked at, there is the Gable film that had come out, and the creation of the Tim Cook song, right? Tim Cook. Yeah. Tim Cook song. That had come out in the 70s and, 80s. 80s. Okay. Yeah. I don't have my outline in front of me. Oh yeah. It was 87, wasn't it?
Yeah. 87. Yeah.
Yes. and really kind of hone in on, the scene that he created with that song and how that kind of has spurred perhaps more Dogman activity, and looked at, History Channel's Monster Quest episodes about it, because they focus in on the Tim Cook song and the Gable film a lot. And that was a fun one. I felt like a big debunker with it, but it was fun putting all of the pieces together and talking about, these different sources that were apparently, I'm using quotes there, that were apparently referenced in some of these sightings, like Tim Cook saying he had a diary from the 1800s where some farmers or something had seen the dog man. It's like, okay, like, well, where is this journal? We're historians. We like footnotes. So is this in your possession? Did you find it at an archive? Is it in a repository somewhere? Or probably you made it up. but
that never happens in the paranormal.
No,
nobody ever makes anything up.
No, but that one was fun. And, Aaron, I don't think knew too much about Dogman. So he had a trial by fire.
I knew about the song. I knew about the song, because I was doing a weird Michigan presentation, at the college I work at for a community sort of education fun day. And, somebody said, what about the talking about Dogman? I'm like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. And so they schooled me on this is somebody I worked with. So they knew I was incompetent. So, they told me about the Dogman song. Like, so the whole Dogman thing is basically down to this song, right? Like, yep. The DJ from Traverse City who just sort of made a song. It's like, it's called The Legend. So it's like this invented tradition of Dogman sightings
every 7 years,
because what other number would you use besides 13? Right. So a spooky number, 7. And so every 7 years, the Dogman appears, except in years, that's not the every 7. It's when you look at it, when you look at the story of it carefully, it's so clear. This is a manufactured thing. Now, that's not to discount the fact that people have had strange encounters mm-hmm. with dog-like creatures in various places. I'm I'm sure they believe they have. But oh, that sounded dismissive, didn't it?
It did.
It did. I'm sure they believe they have. But no, I stand by that dismissal. But yeah, it's clear that at least this aspect of the dog creature cryptid thing is very much a mm-hmm. PR thing. And the YouTube film, the Gable film is it's fun to watch. I mean, I love mm-hmm. sort of made up found footage things. I had my dad buy me a 1995 camcorder so I could do the same sort of thing this summer if I have time. But it's very clearly, you know, fake, but fun.
I don't know. When I was 20 years old, sitting in my dorm room at college watching that, I was terrified.
I like to say self-generating instead of fake.
Self-generating. That's good. That's good.
Alan Greenfield says there's no such thing as a hoax, Aaron. I have seen the Gable film.
Okay.
It is sufficiently freaky, but I was like, when I first watched it, there's no way that's real. I didn't know it was called the Gable film. I just saw it. You know, it's got you see the dog man, and then like the next thing you see is like eyes and like a snout in the camera, and then the camera falls.
It's like, is he being attacked by a furry? Was it happening?
I think, Samantha, you mentioned that it was supposed to have been a series that guy was going to do or something.
Yeah, he did put out a second one. And I think that's where the big mistake was, because the second one is complete. I mean, it's like supposed to be the police like stumbling upon and investigating these mutilated bodies.
No. Nice.
It's awful.
The bodies were very fake looking. It was... Yeah. Yeah, it was bad. You got a nice little fake video there. Why? Yeah,
took it too far.
Yeah.
Flew too close to the sun.
That's right.
Killed the mystery.
That's right.
It gives you that whole, like, I guess that Patterson film kind of vibe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The first one.
And, definitely.
Yeah. Dog Man is, that's hot stuff right now. Now here's another one it kind of goes going down the list that I made, the Witch's Castle. I thought this one was really interesting because you've got a little bit of, you've got the urban legend aspect to it, but you've also got this kind of like satanic panic aspect to this too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which one of us came up with the Witch's Castle thing?
I found it on a list of, you know, I don't know, then, creepy myths then, or whatever. And then you jumped on that one because I had just wrapped up a lot of Dog Man stuff, I think. And so you dove into that.
I went to college about half an hour away from the Witch's Castle. So I have a friend from college who lives in from Charlestown, Indiana, not too far from Utica. So I was familiar with the area. And once I got into the story, so there's like this legend of witches, and there's a castle, and it goes back to George Rogers Clark and, you know, the founding of cities on the Ohio River. But it all sort of culminates in this horrific, horrific torture and murder of a high school girl back in the 90s. And once I got into it, I realized that, you know, I remember in high school reading these newspaper stories about this girl. It was like sort of, what was it? Like a teen sort of junior high girl love triangle thing that ended up with this girl being beaten to death and then burned alive. And
she was rode around in the trunk of the car for a while. Yeah. I mean, just horrible.
It was like they tortured her at this, like, I think the technical term for it is like not a folly, but it was like a sort of stone chapel thing built on a property that had fallen into disrepair that mm-hmm. becomes known as the Witch's Castle. It does not date back further than the 20th century, despite mm-hmm. what you may read on the internet. Mm-hmm. But they did some of the torture there. They killed her in the county where I went to college. But the Witch's Castle, because it had that nickname, becomes synonymous with this crime. And there was some, you know, were rituals being conducted at sacrifices and murders conducted at the Witch's Castle? And if you read the stories beyond the headline, the upshot is usually no. We've got no evidence of that. But it's 1992, 1993, and you're still in the tail end of that, you know, the satanic panic stuff, mm-hmm. which I was going to say I'm a huge fan of. I'm hugely interested in it. ever a huge fan of Satanic Panic. I'm very interested in it hits all my sort of bad conspiracy buttons, and I watched the Geraldo special live back in the day.
The Geraldo special is great.
It's
excellent.
I remember I was in junior high. My mom walks in the room and she's like, "What are you watching? Geraldo's telling us about Satan, Mom." But
didn't they have Michael Aquino? Wasn't he on that?
Yeah, Michael Aquino, who is, if you know about Michael Aquino, but Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino of Mind Control fame. It was very, very interesting because it had this sort of fake history aspect of, you know, they sent three witches on a raft down the Ohio into the falls and they died and cursed the town. It's like,
well, yeah. And it was, wasn't it? There were some of them, they were witches, and in others, they were, weren't they Native American women? Yeah. Like there were a bunch of different interpretations and versions of what the story was that had been passed down and very clearly was all made up.
Yeah.
So the hysteria of that current moment, like reached back to find this continuing thread.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like, we have no solid evidence here, but what if, you know, what if this isn't new? What if this is a curse that was placed on it by witches and or non-white people, you know, back in the day? So very, very much like that.
The witch's castle itself, what was its history? Cause it's not like it's very exciting. It's
just, it's very boring. It's a small chapel shaped building that was part of an estate, you know, at this house in Utica, Indiana, sort of halfway up a hill right in the Ohio Valley. And by the time we get to the 90s, it had passed through a couple owners and had mostly fallen down. But yeah, it was just a small building on the property. It had not much history of its own.
And we had actually found some, like somebody wrote in talking about like how their grandfather or something had been involved in the building. Do you remember? I can't remember the details on there. I pulled up the outline to see if I could find it. But people were like, yeah, no, this, what you're all saying is total crap because like my grandpa said that he worked on that
My grandpa did the mortar work in 1937 or something like that. Yeah. It's not old. It's not ancient. It was the creepiest thing about it is that it is in the general vicinity of where George Rogers Clark sort of established military control over the Ohio Valley in the 1790s, 80s and 90s. It's one of those things where you think there's something there and the deeper you dig, the less you find.
But these like abandoned or liminal places and then in some abandoned industrial places too really become the center point of a lot of the Satanic Panic stuff, because these are like kind of teen hangouts, and then often there's crime, and then if there's a violent crime, it really explodes into like this place that these satanic rituals have been done at, and
right.
And reached into, like, you know, one of the girls who was part of this group of horrible girls doing horrible things, you know, well, she played Dungeons and Dragons her parents were worried about her with this and that. And so they totally, you know, played that into this whole story of like, well, clearly there was more going on here because D&D.
Yeah. There's a podcast, will actually started out as a graphic novel. We've had him on, The Return to Snakeland. I don't know if you've heard him. This guy's on my show. Jason Gusman and Aaron O'Brien. They did a graphic novel about this place in Buffalo, New York that kind of reminds me of that. And it's just it's an old like grain silo, and all these kids would hang out there and drink and party, and they would tell stories, and then there were actual murder. There was an actual murder that happened there in the 1980s. This young girl got killed,
and all these metalheads were already hanging out there, drawing pentagrams, and spray paint everywhere. So it
kind of became this place that had this aura about it because of what happened there, and it reminds me very much of that. Just like the word of mouth and the urban legends that get started over an area that, you know, Timothy Renner, you know, his book Beyond the Seventh Gate, you know, he talks a lot about that, how in his area of Pennsylvania that there's, you know, oh, the seven gates of hell. And he set out to really try to find out, you know, were there really seven gates of hell? And a lot of, but there's not, but there's, but there is an interesting history that's involved with all this stuff still.
Yeah. I wish there had been an interesting history with this one. I was kind of disappointed. I was hoping for, you know, oh, did George Rogers Clark mention these witches in a journal? No, he did not.
It's not even a castle.
What was the,
or a castle.
This is kind of going back to our last episode, but with Walter Bosley, but what was the connection to Prince Madoc?
That was mostly me wanting to talk about Prince Madoc. So there is, the legend, the Welsh legend of, or the United Kingdom legend of a Welsh prince named Madoc sailing across the Atlantic and up the Mississippi and to the Ohio and establishing forts along all these places that, this was supposedly one of the places where Prince Madoc had been. And what I think is interesting about Prince Madoc is nothing about the fake sailing to America stuff, but it's about, this is, a justification for English imperialism in North America because, we were there before the Spanish and French.
Yes.
My gosh.
I think that's behind a lot of archaeological hoaxes and speculation.
Yeah. Or the other thing is, it's like Prince Madoc is the symbol of Welsh nationalism. It's not the British Empire. It's the Welsh Empire. You know, we started all this. No, you didn't. Go back to mining coal. But no offense to Welsh people out there. Your choirs are amazing. But hey, I like the Welsh. I got no problem with the Welsh. So it's, the Madoc thing is interesting, and it sort of gets dragged into it because it's in that general sort of river valley-ish area where Madoc supposedly established these forts, because heaven forbid we give native people any credit for building anything. It's good. Europeans had to do this. I mean, look, it's made with rocks.
Yeah, and that's a whole nother rabbit hole. If anyone doesn't really know about it, you know, you get all these legends of Indians who are supposedly, you know, sounded like they're speaking Welsh, and they look a little more lighter, and you know,
and that goes back to the Roanoke Island thing too. Is you know, well, they came inland, and if you see blonde blue eyed Indians up in the hills, they're the descendants of the Roanoke colony. It's like,
gone to Croatan.
Yeah, gone to Croatan.
The Madoc stuff, I think, enters into the Mandan stuff, which I think,
yes,
you know, Lewis and Clark were real interested in that when they went up there. But that's more, I think, like North Dakota, maybe some of Minnesota too. But
and Andrew Jackson, in his one of his State of the Union addresses, you know, refers to the ancient white people who built the mounds and everything, and says, you know, we're not doing anything to the Indians that they didn't do to the noble races who came before. You know, it's like, and so people cite that as back then they admitted the truth, and now it's been covered up by the politically correct historians. It's like, no, Jackson didn't know anything. You know?
Yeah, he was heavily influenced by the father of Tennessee history, this guy named John Haywood.
Yep.
And
who's buried here in Nashville.
Yeah, we went to his grave, actually. And then he is also still cited constantly on these second and third hand giant mummies being found in caves and mounds. Like, still to this day, they say John Haywood knew, you know, and the Smithsonian came and took them all.
Yeah, it's all a big cover-up.
Yeah, that's a whole interesting history in and of itself. And I mean, that gave justification for the Indian removal as well.
It was one of them. It's like, this is just the pattern of history. You know, they swept somebody away, so we're sweeping them away, you know, and gold and farmland.
Yes.
I'm going to talk about Mackinac Island. This is an interesting place. Of course, what I really want to know is if they still do like the somewhere in time conventions up there.
I don't know if they have. I feel like there's a somewhere in time weekend or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they all dress up in period clothing. And
Yeah, it seems like that's a thing the Grand Hotel does. I worked on the island the summer of 2007, and I can't remember if they had something like that then or not, but you know, that's a big part of all the carriage tours and everything is, you know, the somewhere and signs all over the island talk, you know, Christopher Reeves was here. This is where Jane Seymour did this. So.
Wow. Claim to fame.
Yes.
But apparently it is pretty haunted, or at least people claim that it is haunted.
Yeah. So I worked there. Yeah. For a summer. I actually worked at a Starbucks. But while I had some weird personal experiences while I was there, in sort of the dorm, the company that I worked for that owned several things on the island. They put all of the girls up in this like weird dorm thing above one of the fudge shops downtown. And, there were just a couple of oddball things there. I left my room and came back and all my stuff was like shoved off of the dresser and nobody saw anybody go into my room or whatever. That was an odd one for sure. And like, nothing was missing. I had like my wallet out on my bed and different things like that. And nothing gone. Right. Like I'm a pretty likable person. People don't generally like attack my stuff. So that was weird, but the island itself has such a like long history and so many different people have been there and passed through it, from indigenous peoples to the French and the British and the Americans and, war, all these kinds of things that it's just sort of ripe for the storytelling, as well as, you know, some actual truly horrific things that happened on the island that, you know, it would make complete sense that, that there would be something lingering, after that. And also like, just sort of the transience of it, you know, whether it's soldiers moving through, or it was a trading post for the Native Americans or tourism or whatever it was, people just always moving through the space, and you get all the water and the limestone, just so many things I think that could contribute to sort of the harboring of spirits, memories, whatever that could be.
Hauntology.
Yes, definitely.
What were some of the things that happened on the island? Some of the bad events.
So, I mean, there's war, this is a big one. And so the island, well, of course, originally Native Americans, and then the French, and the British came to control it. And then with the war after the American Revolution, then the Americans had it, then the War of 1812, British took, you know, so there's just a lot of back and forth. And so there is this big Battle of Mackinac Island that takes place. You get soldiers wounded and things like that. So that obviously plays a big role. The old fort site, or one of the oldest, the oldest fort site is at the top of the island, Fort Holmes. And that was a place that I had always like heard, oh, Fort Holmes is super haunted. But we had a friend of mine who worked on the island for 7 or 8 summers in a row, I think. And I can't remember exactly. And she said she never had weird things, you know, happen there. So she never thought of Fort Holmes as being one of the more haunted spaces on the island. But then there's a Indian boarding school that was on the island, which is supposedly very, very haunted for obvious sort of reasons.
Was that in the same hotel that the place that you were staying in, or was that the other?
Claire stayed there. Yes, yeah. I did not. So the state employees that worked at the park, so the Mackinac State Historic Park, which is what she did. So she stayed at the old boarding house.
Yeah, I envision it's kind of like Harper's Ferry. I don't know if
oh, I've never been to Harper's Ferry.
Well, like in that old town section, like cars are not allowed.
Right.
At all. And you walk around and there's just like they've got all the buildings preserved and everything. Just each building has something to do with like Harper's Ferry history. There's like one building that's dedicated to the John Brown raid there and such. And Mackinac Island kind of reminds me of that a little bit. But like, there's no cars at all available. You cannot drive at all on that island.
Right. Yeah. There's a few emergency vehicles and that's it. There isn't even, you know, a ferry that takes cars to the island. In the spring, they bring all the horses back to the island. And that's how all deliveries business, everything is conducted on the island.
I'd never put it together, the sort of parallel to Harper's Ferry. I've been to both places, and I remember it's a lot like that. It's because I went to Harper's Ferry once on one of my history road trips. So I was checking out Civil War stuff a few years ago, and I expected like there to be a museum about the John Brown raid, and that was it. But no, it was this like you got rafting, you like whitewater rafting, you got all this tourist stuff. You can't park anywhere near anything because there's no cars allowed in this old. I walked a bunch of battlefields that trip, but I think I walked the most from my car to actually into Harper's Ferry.
Yeah, I took the bus in to Harper's Ferry.
I didn't know there was a bus. That would have been
helpful. Yeah. But I mean, I walked a lot. I walked all over, and then like the Appalachian Trail runs right through it, and it's not the geographic, but it's more kind of like the emotional or mental center of the midpoint of the Appalachian Trail, if that makes sense. So they've got this whole center there that you can go to. And I mean, there's tons of history there. I mean, just like, and there's NAACP used to meet there too, a lot, back in the early 20th century. So you've got all, you know, it's an incredible place. And I kind of imagine Mackinac's kind of the same way.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something interesting happens when you almost see these moments in time. Not to be all Christopher Reevesy, like overlapping, because, you know, like people get off the ferry, they're in their modern day life, and all of a sudden, you know, they're dodging horses and buggies and people on bicycles, and a soldier on break from the fort walks by in costume, and, you know, downtown still looks very old downtown Mackinac Island. And then if you travel into the interior, which I think is far more interesting, all these interesting geological features as well. But I mean, it's just this layering of times that I think you get that's super interesting in a place like that.
And sort of on top of that, you've got the modern people coming off the ferry into the old timey place. Sorry to use the phrase old timey. but at the same time, in the old timey place, you walk in and it's a souvenir shop.
Yeah.
That's very modern, or a Starbucks, or, you know, it's really is layering. It's multiple layers. It's ping ponging back and forth between the present and the past. And,
well, yeah. Cause then if you go a street back, you know, you can go through the Biddle House, you know, and so you can act and you can go into the fort and you can go into some of these other places that then, you know, teach you the history, but also transport you into a space that feels much more historical than just a gift shop. And this is the type of like history play stuff that I geek out a lot about. So I could go on about that, but.
Is it a national park or a state park?
State park.
State park.
Yeah.
Why is it not a national park? That confuses me. I've always sort of assumed it was national until I was set straight by Samantha and Claire at some point, but it's just this War of 1812 battle site. It's, you know, a significant
state owns it. Place. I don't know. It's Mackinac State Historic Parks.
I don't know. It just seems like it needs to get promoted to like a national historic site. Because like there's like some.
Well, it could still be a national historic landmark.
Right.
Like the house museum I run is a national historic landmark, but we're not owned by it.
Need some sort of higher
probably is
status.
You want the UNESCO World Patrol.
I want the New World Order to come in and take over Mackinac Island. We can put some FEMA camps on there.
Totally mundane question, Samantha.
Yeah.
Completely mundane, not supernatural in any way, but like you worked at a Starbucks.
I did.
So being that there's no cars on the island, how did you get shipments? They had to bring trucks in at some point, right?
No, so the shipments come to the ferry on the mainland in Mackinac City, and then the horse-led drays meet the ferry at the dock and load it up and cart it back. I have unloaded a few drays in my time. There was this one guy who his license plate. His name was Ray, and he was Big Ray on the dray. So you always knew when Big Ray was coming by, you had your milk shipment coming in.
Do they have those Wells Fargo no. cars coming by? They could do some holdups.
Get the Budweiser Clydesdales to sort
oh,
of.
Oh yeah. Well, they're all. Oh gosh, what are all of those horses? I mean, because they're big draft horses. Mm-hmm. Most of them who lead all the carriage tours. I can't. And they're a specific kind. And they even have like their special winter place on the mainland that they go in, Pitchford or some. I don't remember. But yeah.
Percheron.
Are they?
That's a horse. I know it from a Jethro Tull song. It
is. Well, yeah, that is a horse. I don't think they're Percherons. I don't remember.
I understand that it's well known for its fudge.
Yes.
That's what I was told by some Michiganders I know as well. So,
breaking news last night: the guy who founded the Ribas Fudge Shops, which was the family company that I worked for, they also own the Starbucks. He passed away yesterday. So,
really?
Yes.
This is huge.
It is rocking the Mackinac Island world, I am sure.
How y'all doing? My name is Shelby Hoffman Jr., and I'm here with my friend.
I'm Orvis James III.
And we're here to talk about the truth about the Conspiranormal podcast.
Well, you know, usually, you know, we listen to the programs on WWCR, but sometimes we like to listen to podcasts, and we used to listen to the Conspiranormal podcast until, you know, we learned the truth and started hearing them talking about joining up from their Patreon or something like that. I don't know what that is. And trying to get folks involved in all this here mess.
Now, you might say, hey, you know, that's one of my favorite podcasts, and it seems like a couple of all right Tennessee boys just interested in exploring the mysteries like everyone else. But in fact, Adam Sane is a known occultist.
That's right, he is.
And that Surfer Adam, just say his damn name.
I don't know.
He has just gone even more downhill into the pits of hell since he joined.
I agree, Shelby, and we're going to demonstrate with evidence that this podcast, this Conspiranormal, and the events and the people connected to it are part of this like hidden network of secret societies who operate behind the scenes.
Now, they're using this podcast to recruit for these secret societies. And now we know everyone wants to be in a club, and there's nothing wrong with that, but these groups promoted by Conspiranormal... Yep. That promise this hidden wisdom,
I know.
We know are, in fact, occult in nature.
All right, so look, you know, we're not saying that the average person who is a member of one of those societies really knows what's going on, because they really don't. I mean, they just probably like the fellowship and, you know, hanging out, drinking the punch, and going to the Strange Realities Conference and, you know, hanging out with their friends and such, and... You know, playing pool on a Friday night, and they don't know who really pulls the strings at Conspiranormal. That's it, yeah. And in the entire thing is like one big pyramid where everyone at the lower levels don't really know what's going on at the top. So, did you know that they has their regular weekly podcast?
Now they have the regular weekly program.
Oh, that's right, a program, yeah.
And there's a reason why they call it a program, you see? But they also have secret transmissions reserved only for the members of these secret societies.
Yep.
Who are up to date on their dues, of course, now, because now we know it's all about money. So these special episodes, now they're not meant for the profane like us, you see?
Yeah.
You see, they have to join and become one of them, a conspiranormalist, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, Shelby, that's how they get you. You just don't want to miss out on some extra conversations that's going on and these shows, so you think, well, what the heck, you know? I mean, you go and you join the International Association Conspiranormalist for only like $5 a month or something, and just like that, your foot's in the door, right? And now you got the access to communicate directly with, you know, Adam, he's a known occultist, and your other brothers and your sisters, but that's only where it begins.
Well, that's right. But then they start to tell you that it is in fact an ancient order that goes all the way back to the Knights Templars, and even further back to the ancient mystical Egypt, if you believe it.
Next time what we're going to do, we're going to tell you about another one of these organizations. They got called the Mystic Crew. And, you know, we'll be back. We're going to expose these guys. We're going to take them down.
And you can find them and all that mess at patreon.com/conspiranormal.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Wow.
Quick moment of silence, guys.
Well, let's take a few more. I want to cover, and these are some that I have not gotten to yet. So you guys did do a couple shows about you. I think you did a couple shows about the Wendigo, which that is okay. Just one. That is a subject that I'm really fascinated by, and that is something that is really specific to that region, as I understand it.
So as we researched it, we actually found that there are Wendigo stories that stretch throughout like the northern United States and into Canada, all the way like out to Alaska, which I had no idea about. But obviously it's very, very this sort of Great Lakes, US and Canada region. It's very prevalent here.
Yeah, and it's sort of linked to, and there's different variations on the word, but it's all sort of the Algonquian tradition, which I had no idea the Algonquian sort of cultural group was so far flung and so widespread. I assumed it was sort of compact, because sometimes you forget the difference between cultural groups and tribal variations within a cultural group, because that's, you know, a sort of thing. I think the Wendigo thing was... really interesting to me, not just because of sort of the indigenous origins of Wendigo stories, but the way that it has been taken and twisted and manipulated as this is a diagnosis of a certain kind of psychopathology that affects some of these native peoples when they're starving, you know, sort of the cannibalism aspect of it,
right.
The pop culture stuff. Sam made me watch Supernatural.
I did.
Yeah, a couple episodes of Supernatural for the Patreon. It wasn't bad. I didn't hate it. I made her watch the worst X-Files episode of all time.
I had already seen it.
Shapes from the first season. It's sort of the Native American werewolf creature. It's pretty bad. The only good thing about it is that there's lots of callbacks to the 1973 Wounded Knee standoff, and that's why they don't trust the FBI, which is
that's right.
Leonard
Peltier
word. As a post World War II history guy, I'm like, yes, this is good. That's a good call. But the rest of it was just
And also not Wendigo-y at all as we were watching it. It was like, yeah, this is just a werewolf story. This is not.
I just wanted to watch an X-Files episode.
Yeah.
Were there any stories about the Wendigo that stuck out to you from that episode?
So I was actually really surprised as we started researching it, the different cases that popped up. You know, there was this one with a guy who's referred to as Swift Runner, and he was known for being a Wendigo hunter. And so whenever a Wendigo had cropped up in a town, he would go out and dispatch of the Wendigo, which of course was just a person. So as the Canadian officials, because this happened in Canada, heard about this, they're like, well, this guy's just out murdering people. We can't do this. And so they arrested him and his brother, and he escaped and hung himself. Was that, oh gosh, I can't remember now. Do you remember, Aaron?
I think that's what
I think. I think he escaped and committed suicide. And then the other, his brother stayed in prison and was hanged as well. But I mean, so you get a lot of these obviously cultural issues between like, this is our belief system and, you know, the community thinks we're doing what's right. We think we're doing what's right, but obviously the Canadian government, not so keen on that. But I had no idea that we would find, I guess, perhaps naively, these actual cases where like Wendigos came into play. I really thought we would just largely be investigating this tale. We'd have some good old indigenous folklore that we'd be sharing. We'd talk about some pop culture implications, but we found, I think we talked about three different people in the episode in particular. Yeah, Aaron, you look like you're about to say something.
Yeah, there was another case from about a year after the last great indigenous sort of rebellion against the Canadian government, where a group of Native Americans killed a woman in their community because she was supposedly a Wendigo, and they were put on trial for murder. And there's this whole sort of colonial justice system judicial thing where, you know, they're like, can we convict them of murder if they truly believed they were protecting their people? And the decision was, you know, we're not comfortable doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, so sort of and I found this case in like a legal journal article from about 10 years ago, where it's like one of sort of this larger context of how colonial jurisprudence was beginning to shift in the late 19th and early 20th century away from, well, this is how you should do it, to we really need to, you know, acknowledge that these people do not believe the way we do. And they acknowledged it in a very sort of paternalistic, imperialistic way, as these poor backward people don't understand reality. But, you know, it's sort of a slight move toward, I don't want to say cultural relativism, but, you know, just sort of nodding in that direction. And like Sam said, I thought it would be like old stories of the Wendigo eating people. And no, it's like 19th century legal cases and criminal cases where these belief systems are coming into contact with the Western world and sort of that conflict there.
And I just want to say I messed up the names, so just look back at the outline. And I was talking about Jack Fiddler. Swift Runner was another guy who ate his family that we talked about. So, you know.
There was also the guy in the, I think in British Columbia, I think he was on a bus and he like killed this other guy.
I think he was
one of our patrons mentioned that.
Native American, I think.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people have said that, well, you know, I don't know how sensationalistic this is. Say, well, he had the Wendigo spirit and these type of things. And there's a great movie HBO did called Antlers, which is actually a pretty decent horror movie that plays with the whole Wendigo mythology. And
it's actually pretty,
I think I came across that a couple times while I was Googling things.
Yeah, it's got kind of an environmental kind of message to it.
Oh, it's got Kerry Russell in it.
Yeah. So the last couple that I got are kind of fun ones. We'll get away from people eating each other. I'm going to try to pronounce this. Ladon Rouge, the little red dwarf. And I've talked to John Tenney about this before, but since he is a Detroiter, but I don't know if that's Detroiter. I don't know if that's the way you say it. This is the little red dwarf that I guess is kind of like a... I guess he's kind of like a... what is it? A harbinger of doom, I guess, usually considered.
That's what he's usually considered. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This was another one that I definitely wanted to make sure that we covered, especially early on in the show, because I'd always heard about it and was interested in it. And this one was fun, like as a, you know, sort of folklore research too, because there's this whole story about, you know, the, Cadillac seeing the Nain Rouge and disrespecting the Nain Rouge. And so that is you know, why the French lost Detroit, and then Detroit would fall later. And as the Nain Rouge appears at some other pivotal points in Detroit's history, before an ice storm, before the 1967 race riots, you know, this all can be traced back to, you know, this early Frenchman who disrespected the Nain Rouge. And, you know, everything that we found really pointed back to this one historical document from the 1880s, this woman who shared the story. And, you know, we couldn't go any further back than that with it. So
there's no like letter from Cadillac to right. his friend in Paris saying,
I just saw this.
I really screwed up. I insulted the Nain Rouge and now we've lost Detroit. You know, it's like, shoot. No,
I insulted a red dwarf. He's not very happy with me right now.
It's going to happen. But what's interesting is like the name, the sort of small, sort of irritable red dwarf is, you know, you can trace the story back to Normandy in France. You know, there are, you know, folkloric tales from the 1600s of, you know, mischievous, impish, trickster like dwarfs that you don't screw with them. But then there's Native American sort of tales of Pukwudgies, which is one of my favorite words.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, and
just like Ballyhoo is another favorite.
Ballyhoo, yeah. In the most recent Saucer of Life, I proclaim Ballyhoo to be a word that we need to use, and not mayhap. I despise the word mayhap, but yeah. So there's this sort of like a little bit of the native legend might be there, a little bit of European legend might be there, and you get these things passed down somehow, or at least absorbed by this woman who in the 1880s decides to weave this tale of Cadillac and the Nain Rouge. And the Nain Rouge ends up being the bad guy in modern day. The parade is to drive the Nain Rouge out of the city. And it's like, dude, the Nain Rouge was just minding his own business.
He's like the scapegoat now.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
completely.
He absolutely is. The small non-white being is the scapegoat for all of Detroit's problems. You know, put that together in your head.
Yeah.
But but people like Danny are, you know, sort of doing their protests. And I wish I would have been able to go down this year.
We had talked about going.
We talked about it, but then we decided
we didn't want to be in crowds of people. That was our decision. Yeah.
Not any sort of like public health thing. I do not like being in crowds of people. They they don't like me. I tend to get
not health, just agoraphobia.
Right. You know, it's after 2 years of public health crises, I don't leave my basement. But
you got a nice Michigan basement, I can see.
I've got it. This is actually not. There's actually a term, a Michigan basement. It's actually an architectural term for a basement that you could spend time in, but you don't want to.
Dirt floors and such.
Yeah, dirt floor. It's uneven dirt floors. It gets wet.
Oh, that's a specific term that means.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. My parents, part of their basement is a Michigan basement. Yeah. So, yes.
Our last house was built in the 20s, and the realtor was like, it's got a Michigan basement, but it's been tiled over, and the drainage is pretty good. It's still flooded. But but
no, yours looks actually nice. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's a basement in Michigan, but not a Michigan.
Okay.
So feel free to edit that out. But yeah, so the Nain Rouge sort of gets scapegoated.
There's a lot of problems with the parade. Like, I was already skeptical on the parade, and then the more we read about it, and there's a lot wrong with the parade.
I think that's a reoccurring theme in a lot of America reassessing a lot of its big parades. You got the Mummers, and then you've got the Veiled Prophet Parade in St. Louis, and they all have a lot of kind of weird racist stuff going on.
Yeah, it's the Nain Rouge Parade isn't that old. I mean, it's a 21st century phenomenon. It's you know,
it's already there.
Yeah, it's already than popping all up. Yeah, but it's more like this is a good enough story. Let's just go with that sort of thing because it's theatrical and fun and adversarial.
But guys in colonial dress, which people are encouraged to dress up. And, you know, we've read some things talking about the colonial dress folks proclaiming they need to drive out the red guy is just a bad vibe to be promoting anywhere, anytime.
Yeah, it just seems a little off to me.
Is there anything we wanted to add about the Nain Rouge? I don't want to make him mad. So let's not.
The Nain Rouge is cool.
I think we're advocating for him.
I've got a sticker on my laptop about how much I love the Nain Rouge. So he's not going to mess with me.
Cool. Nice.
All right, so we're gonna close this out with the most exciting cryptid you have ever heard of, and that is the Beast of Busco, Oscar the Turtle.
Oscar the Turtle from near my hometown. It's where my dentist was growing up, but same county. But yeah, back in the 40s, there was supposedly a giant turtle that was in a undrained field. Basically, it was just sort of a swampy area. In Indiana, we don't have swamps like in Michigan. We drained them all to plant soybeans. Right. So it's you know, supposedly this big turtle called the Beast of Busco in Cherubusco, Indiana. And they tried to find it. They brought out experts from Philadelphia to find it back in the 40s. Nobody could find it. The town decided to make a festival around it, Turtle Days. And Cherubusco is now Turtle Town, USA, for this one semi-mythical turtle. And it's a great example of how you can take a creature that, even if it's real, is not exciting. It's just a turtle that's a little bigger than normal for Indiana. But you use it as a way to fundraise, to build the new community center. And you've got the elephant ears and the funnel cakes and the corn dogs and all that. And it's going to this very day. And it's, what's the value in cryptids? The value in cryptids is community engagement and fundraising.
Mascot.
It's a mascot. You can make money off this thing. You make hats and t-shirts. It's great. There's no deeper meaning.
So my question is, Oscar was seen.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Yes.
How big is he supposed to be?
About the size of a dining room table, I think is what the newspaper said, which is the worst measuring room.
So, I mean, I don't see how that would be impossible for a snapping turtle.
No, it's completely plausible. It's what amuses me is that it gets lumped in as a cryptid. It's not a cryptid. It's a literal turtle. We know what turtles are. They're not.
It almost fits into that category of cryptids that are like these leftovers from dinosaur times. You
know? Yeah, right.
Like this is a sort of preternatural turtle or a primordial turtle of some kind.
The story that I loved was that they were trying to find him, or they were trying to drain the swamp or whatever, and they brought in a female turtle so that he would be interested.
Yeah, you got the
female. She just wasn't
turtle.
Big enough for him.
I just want to let you know that the saucer wife just texted me that turtles are mysterious AF. So that's the saucer wife's contribution. But she's apparently, I'm very loud and she can hear me in a different part of the house. But they bring in a female turtle to strut that ass around the pond. And Oscar is supposed to, you know, get up on it somehow. It didn't work, apparently. Not sashaying well enough.
I just want to know who the person was that had that bright idea. Like, well, you know, maybe if we got a female turtle, we dropped it in there. Maybe Oscar
assuming
will come
that
out.
Oscar's male, like
yes, that's yeah. true. That's a big assumption.
His name is Oscar, so
right. Yeah.
How,
yeah. To me.
How do you sex a turtle? I mean, determine the biological, not sex a turtle, but you know. I mean, I don't know how to do that either.
What was the big kaiju turtle? What was the big?
Gamera.
Gamera. Yeah, he was the turtle. Yeah,
he's friend to children. Yes. As the movie said, Gamera is friend. Sam, have you seen Gamera?
No.
That's going to be a Patreon extra. We're going to watch Gamera.
In closing, guys, what's next for you on the show? What are some of the other topics that you guys are going to hit coming up?
Currently, we are working on an episode about secret societies in Chicago. We're going to specifically look at the Whitechapel Club, which is a group of newspaper men, some elite guys who apparently drank toast to Jack the Ripper and had a really weird funeral pyre for some guy who committed suicide, took his body out to the shores of Lake Michigan and lit them on fire and read some Byron. So it'll be
the interesting thing is he committed suicide because he was told that he needed to, because he was the head of the league for
the suicide,
the suicide club. So it's like
of Texas or something.
Put your money where your mouth is and kill yourself. So he did. And then they, you know, burned his body in a funeral pyre. And we're also planning, and this is me blatantly trying to cross over with the Saucer Life audience, going to be covering the swamp gas UFO sightings from the 1960s in southeastern Michigan, Hillsdale and Dexter. So that's on the horizon. Mm-hmm. Have we planned out any further than that, Sam?
No.
We haven't.
We planned really solidly at first, and now it's like we'll get sort of 3 or 4 weeks, and then
we're very busy people.
Yeah, it's a great show, guys. Thank you so much for coming on and being a part of this tonight. And I think we're going to do a Patreon as well with you, Aaron, and Samantha. We'd love for you to stay if you can. Where can people find the shows? And also, Aaron, we'll start with you.
I'm on Twitter at Saucer Life, and the Saucer Life half of the Cheezo Media Media Empire is at saucerlife.com. And Sam can tell us where Great Lakes Lore is.
Yeah, so we are on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook as Great Lakes Lore. And I mean, that's it. That's pretty straightforward.
there's the website.
Oh yeah, greatlakeslore.com. Forgot that one. But yeah, we add some extra bonus photos and further reading links and stuff like that for all of our episodes there. So folks who are really interested can hopefully see a few of the things that we're talking about and dive in deeper if they want to.
And Samantha, where can people contact you?
Yeah, so I am on Twitter as Samantha Engel 76, and that's where I'm generally most active. On Instagram, I'm Founding Fangirl Sam because I'm obsessed with the American Revolution. So that's my nerdy history Instagram handle there.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on, y'all.
Yeah. We'd also like to add that Samantha and Aaron will be at the Strange Realities Conference this year, coming up October 14th through the 16th. Not quite sure which of the either Friday or Saturday they'll be speaking, but that will be streaming online and live here at SIR Nashville once again. And I think you guys talked a little bit about what you're going to talk about, but
possibly right.
What would you may talk about? But we're happy to have you guys are going to do a kind of like a tag team kind of presentation, kind of like what we did a few years ago with Joshua Cutchin and Timothy Renner. So,
Yeah.
Hopefully dive into more developments with the Dungeon Swamp mystery and even, you know, how we as historians approach some of this work that we do. So we don't get people looking for ghosts and finding bears instead.
Or looking for bears and finding ghosts. That would be
You know. Yeah.
I am definitely looking forward to that, guys, to seeing that. And
you can meet them in person if you come to Nashville.
Yeah,
meet them
in person. StrangeRealitiesConference.com. The tickets are available. It is $70 if you want to join us here in Nashville. It is $30 if you want to join us online. Same setup as last year. So come join us, guys. We've got these two excellent podcasters. We've got Tim Banal, Adam Gilrightly, John Tinney will be there, Kiki Dombrowski. This is kind of who I'm naming off the top of my head, Nathan Isaac Recluse. We have a lot of people there from last year and some new faces as well. So come join us.
We're also going to have some different formatting. We're going to have some workshops, a lot more interaction, and a lot more fun on Sunday.
And guys, also third Friday of the month, we are doing our online presentations through for Strange Realities. That is a speaker speaking on a topic, and that's going to be on our Patreon, but also you can buy those on Eventbrite as well. And Surfiel can tell you.
You can check us out at patreon.com/conspiranormal, where you can listen to this Patreon episode we have coming up with these guests, as well as other ones, one every week for the $5 and up people. You can join the International Association of Conspiranormalists and get that content. For $10 and up, you get to join the Mystic Crew and attend those said Strange Reality speaking engagements every month for free. So check us out at patreon.com/conspiranormal.
All right, guys, join us next week. We're going to do some treasure hunting on Conspiranormal.
Please consider becoming a Patreon at www.patreon.com/conspiranormal or leave a one-time donation at conspiranormal.com. And please check out our YouTube channel, Conspiranormal Podcast.